What's up, guys? Welcome to Sustainable Submission Radio, dispatch number 4, and our first official podcast episode. And man, I've been waiting for like 2 months to say that out loud. It feels good. So just to give you guys a brief little explanation of what's been going on behind the scenes here, what started out as a weekly email newsletter called The Dispatch that I made just so I could give you guys a little bit of a taste of what's coming while I worked on the actual podcast, that turned into an audio newsletter. And now that is evolving into a full-blown weekly podcast episode. So what does that change? What does that mean for you guys who signed up for the newsletter? Well, nothing. And also everything. We're still going to send you guys out the link every week to The Dispatch to everyone who subscribed, along with some little bonuses throughout the week that are just for our subscribers and for you to find out once you subscribe. And if you stuck with me through the first 3 dispatches and through this transitional phase, I seriously cannot thank you guys enough. You're the heart of why I'm doing this in the first place. As we continue to grow and evolve, I'm hoping to put out multiple episodes per week, but for now, we're going to build small and slow, and we're going to stick with our one weekly deep dive episode that we're going to continue to call The Dispatch. So if you're new around these parts, you picked a hell of a time to tune in, and you're going to be in for a real ride today. So strap in and brace yourself for a trial by fire, sustainable sedition style. If you're still around at the end of today's dispatch, then you truly belong here. Welcome home. So over the past couple weeks, we've introduced a variety of topics, right? We talked about our failing food system. We've talked about the hows and whys of lifestyle preparedness. We've talked about our soil biology and why that's important. And we've covered some really practical strategies that, when used properly, add layers of resilience and regeneration to our chosen lifestyle. This week, we're going to come at things from a little bit of a different angle and dig deeper into the big picture stuff, you know, the meat of it, the deeper why behind everything that we've talked about. So let's get into the thick of it and jump down this rabbit hole, starting with our weekly philosophical discussion, our food for thought. And this week's theme, walking to freedom in a world that's left it behind. So freedom. It's a word that gets thrown around so much, it's damn near lost its meaning entirely. It's been wrapped in flags, plastered on bumper stickers, used by every politician, no matter how authoritarian their policies actually are. But real freedom, the kind that actually means something, now that's a whole different animal. So let's be crystal clear. Freedom is individual by nature. So your version of what freedom looks like might be completely different from what my version of freedom looks like. And that's the point. That's what makes it freedom, because we're both at liberty to choose how we want to live our own lives. Freedom to me is being able to provide for my family on my own terms. It's experimenting with all my crazy projects on the homestead. It's growing my own food, stewarding the land, the ability to learn from my mistakes. It's maintaining a healthy relationship with my partner, and it's teaching my kids everything that I talk about here. It's also being able to speak on everything that I choose to without being filtered or restricted in the things that I can or cannot say. And then it's also accepting the full weight of the consequences when I screw up. So freedom to me is taking accountability and caring for the things that are mine to take care of. Freedom for you might look different, or it might look exactly the same. Freedom for Kevin might be living in a colonial home with a white picket fence and going to work every day where all of his papers are filed and everything always runs on time. Good for Kevin. Now, freedom for Jeff might be living in a nudist colony in the middle of the woods and worshiping a pine tree. Great for Jeff. And as long as Jeff and his nudist buddies don't go kick down Kevin's door and force Kevin into their nudist collective and let Kevin do Kevin, then it's all good. And likewise for Kevin, as long as he doesn't go to the community with a flatbed truck full of polo shirts and khakis, force them onto everyone and make them all wear crosses and pray to Jesus at gunpoint, it's all good. Real freedom, if we had to come up with an objective definition for it, is the ability to live life on your terms, without being coerced, without being controlled, without being forced to play by someone else's rules. As long as you're not stepping on anyone else's ability to do the same, then we're good. We can figure it out. We can work together. Or not. And that's okay too. We can completely disagree and do our own separate things without infringing on each other's freedom of choice. That infringement includes physical harm, manipulation, and coercion, both on the interpersonal, economic, and social level. You don't get to steal from someone else. You don't get to harm them. And you don't get to force your beliefs down their throat. And they don't get to do that to you. And nobody gets to have the state to do it on their behalf. That's the deal. That's the non-aggression principle. The foundational ethic of a truly free society. You do you, I do me, and as long as we're not infringing on each other, we're good. Does that sound reasonable? I think so. Here's the thing, though. Freedom's not easy. It comes with weight. You don't get to blame anyone else when your decisions screw things up. You're the one in charge, and you're the one on the hook for the consequences of what you do. There's no safety nets, there's no bailouts, and there's no external authority to absorb the blow for you. And that's where responsibility kicks in. Because you can't have freedom without taking responsibility for the consequences of your actions. Otherwise, that's not freedom, that's just chaos. And that's exactly what statists love to point at, you know? Look, people can't handle freedom. Look at this mess they made. In reality, that chaotic mess is often the result of centralized mismanagement in the first place. It's not people having freedom that caused the issue. It's the rigid, top-down systems trying to control and micromanage everything, breaking down under their own weight, and then blaming the people that they tried to control. What those people are really saying is, we don't trust people to govern themselves, so we'll do it for them. And the people who say that, they fall into two camps, and neither one of them should be anywhere near power. Most of them are just nihilists, you know? They don't hate people, they've just given up on them. They think that people are too stupid to understand nuance, too impulsive to act rationally, and too lazy to handle responsibility. So they treat society like a zoo, like a controlled environment, where the keepers, the quote-unquote enlightened few, corral the rest of us like zoo animals for everyone's safety. They believe that management is mercy, this kind of soft authoritarianism with a clipboard and a smile. They might even think that they're being benevolent, but they don't believe in human potential. They don't believe in your agency. They want risk reduction. They want predictability. They want a system that they can control. And on top of that, they have enough of an intellectual superiority complex to think that they're the ones to do it. Now the rest? Sociopaths. Yeah, I'm not kidding. And these guys, they're built different, you know? They don't just fear the masses, they despise them. And they assume that everyone else is just like them. These sniveling, cowardly, power-hungry, and manipulative people that are always looking for an angle and need to be kept in check. So they build systems of control to protect themselves from the competition that they imagine is always clawing at their heels. It's projection, plain and simple, is what it is. They want a society that's predictable, manageable, and controllable too, but unlike the nihilist who really believes that it's for the best, the sociopath wants it because it keeps them on top. Neither of these guys are leaders. They're not stewards. They're prison guards. And the result is like an overbearing parent that is constantly hovering over their kid, micromanaging every little thing that they do, never giving them an inch of space to actually figure things out for themselves, and only punishing them for doing the wrong things while never teaching them the right things to do. What the hell do you think is going to happen? Your kid is going to hate you, grow up resentful, comply with your bullshit just long enough to survive it until they can get out on their own, and then they're going to have no idea how to regulate themselves and interact appropriately with other people. They're going to cause harm to others and themselves. Either that or the kid grows up to be a thoughtless, empty drone who doesn't know how to do anything but comply, go through the motions, and never stands up for themselves. That parent might think that they're acting in their child's best interests, but it always backfires. Now, apply that same principle to society as a whole. Does that look familiar? I think so. You know, you create a system that's supposed to keep people in check, and before you know it, that system becomes the biggest violator of freedom that there is. And history is just packed with examples, from the Soviet Union's secret police and Maoist China's cultural purges to the Patriot Act, turning every single American into a potential suspect that can be spied on. History proves, over and over and over, that once power centralizes, it's not long before the people are sacrificed in the name of security. What's professed as a tool to protect the public always, always, without fail, ends up being used to control them. Every single time power centralizes, it rots. It's not natural. Nothing in nature functions that way. Show me one example, just one, of a place in the natural world where true centralized power exists, where one group or being has monopolized control over an entire ecosystem other than humans. You know, it's unnatural. We're the only ones doing it. And that's why it doesn't work. Maybe that's what our problem is. You know, we're the one species in all of nature that's trying to do things this way and then wondering why the hell it doesn't work. And, you know, no, the queen bee doesn't count. She's not some tyrant barking orders. She's a biological function, not a ruler. A bee colony operates on mutual benefit, natural instinct, and shared interest, not force. The moment that the queen stops serving her purpose, she's replaced. No coups, no secret police, just nature doing what works. And ants, bees, and termites, they don't control the whole ecosystem. They have roles, sure, but they don't monopolize the forest, the soil, or the sky. In nature, there are keystone species, but there are no keystone tyrants. So the idea that centralized top-down control is natural is a complete nonsense. Nature runs on networks, not monopolies. So every time someone says, "We need to come together as a society," what they're actually saying is, no, you need to submit to what we think is best. Like, do you really think that your solution is the one-size-fits-all fix? Out of all of the practically infinite possibilities, you really think you found the one true solution? I mean, that's a pretty goddamn bold assumption, considering all the levels of nuance and differing viewpoints and circumstances that people have. Do you really have so much faith in your idea that if people disagree with you or don't want to participate, you're willing to use the force of the state to coerce people under the threat of violence to comply with you? Because that's what you're doing. Do you really think that's the only way to solve the problem? I sure as hell don't. But it's for the greater good. No, it's not. No, it's not. The greater good is just the sum of individual goods. The real kind of good, where people freely choose what's best for themselves, their families, and their communities. When someone claims to represent the greater good, what that usually means is, I've decided what's good for you. And that's the problem with collectivist ideologies like Marxism. Take what people like Stalin and Lenin believed, for example, that the individual can't be free until the masses are free. That's total bullshit. It's total bullshit. And that argument falls in on itself the second that we acknowledge that the masses are made up of individuals. If someone believes it's necessary to restrict individual liberty for the greater good of the masses, they've already justified the cruelty and draconian measures that always, always follow. And it's not the masses who experience that suffering. It's the individual. So the idea that society can have one unified interest or will is in and of itself a myth. Because society is made up of individuals with unique individual interests. Think about every group project that you've ever been in. There's always that one guy, you know? Let's just, for the sake of the story, let's just call him Phil. And Phil decides that Phil knows best. So he takes over. Phil starts assigning everyone's roles, rewrites everyone's parts, and turns the whole thing into Phil's world. What happens? The rest of the group is like, screw Phil. They stop contributing, they get resentful, or they sabotage the whole thing out of spite. And that's what happens when cooperation becomes coercion. But the best group projects, those are the ones where people find their strengths. They pitch in voluntarily, and they build something together that no single person could have pulled off alone. So the truth is, We don't need a fill. You know, we don't need rulers to do the right thing. We don't need bureaucrats or lawmakers. But what about murderers and thieves? Okay, those people are already in violation of the non-aggression principle, and they need consequences, not laws. Be those consequences natural or societal. And like, don't we already have laws that prohibit murder and theft right now that don't stop those people from doing those things anyway? Huh. Don't we have prisons that are literally packed full of people who those laws made no difference to when they were committing violent crimes? We also have prisons that are packed full of people who committed victimless crimes, people who broke completely unnecessary and idiotic, overreaching laws like being in possession of a certain plant. You know, that's a different issue, but you get my point. Just as much as the bad guys make their decisions despite the laws against their actions already being in place, the vast majority of people make sound decisions every day without anyone pointing a gun at their head. We drive on the right side of the road. We help our neighbors during emergencies. We teach our kids not to lie. Not because of laws, but because it's right. And because the consequences of doing otherwise suck. Laws don't make people good. Incentives do. And the strongest incentive of all? Self-interest. The natural law of cause and effect that holds us all personally accountable. You want to act like a fucking jackass? People stop dealing with you. You cheat someone, word gets around. You help someone, they want to help you back. That's real regulation. Organic, earned, and enforced by the people that you deal with every single day. And that was the cornerstone of cultures that existed for centuries before we replaced natural law with this compliance training that we have now. That's the world we're trying to build here, guys. Not some utopia. Just a reality where you're free to live how you want, raise your kids how you see fit, build your own systems, and walk away from the ones that are failing you. And it's not about being left alone to rot in a shack in the woods either. It's about building something better. Something decentralized. Something that's durable. Something that's human. It's about living with ethics and guts. Not because some rule book told you to, but because you chose to of your own free will. All right, pulse check. You still with me? Good. Now you might be thinking, all right, yeah, that all sounds great, but how the hell would this actually work? How do we move from being so tangled up in these centralized systems, corrupted incentives, and artificial dependencies into that kind of decentralized, voluntary, self-regulating way of life? Bingo. You nailed it. That's exactly the question we need to be asking ourselves, every single one of us. Because the reality is, there's no roadmap. There is no 10-step program. There's no glorious social revolution, there's no policy reform, and there's certainly no savior candidate that's going to swoop in like Superman, flip the switch for us, and hand us this way of life. There's only you. Your mindset. Your actions. Your dreams. Your relationships. Your household. Your community. And you're either just another asset to these systems, another pawn in someone else's game being moved wherever they want you, or you're the greatest threat to them because you've rendered them obsolete by removing your dependence on them. Sure, the pawn can stay on the board and make life a little more tolerable by fighting its way across it and becoming a rook or a bishop, maybe even a queen. But it's still stuck on the board. It's still being manipulated. And it's still just another piece protecting the king. Luckily, this isn't chess. This is real life. You have more options than that. But they've convinced you that real change starts with a protest sign or a ballot box. Those are just the squares your chess piece is allowed to move on the board, guys. And no, I'm not a purist. I do think that protest has its place. I do think that getting involved in local politics can be useful, especially when a community bands together to strike down a bad law or remove a restriction that was choking their liberty. But both of those strategies are still just an appeal to authority at the end of the day. They still rely on the system to fix itself. And that means that they miss the core issue entirely. Because real change, it doesn't come from the top. It starts with your daily choices, which you support, which you build, which you walk away from, what you teach your kids when no one's watching, what you grow, what you trade, how you show up for people, and what you're no longer willing to comply with. What was it that Gandalf said from Lord of the Rings, right? Some people believe it is only great power that can hold evil in check. But that is not what I have found. I have found it's the small things, the everyday deeds of ordinary folk that keep the darkness at bay. The shift won't come from demanding or begging the top to loosen its grip, guys. It's going to come from ordinary people, consciously, actively, relentlessly building something better right where they stand. That's the vision. That's what true freedom is and how it works in practice. So now, naturally, let's take a hammer to the idea and see if we can break it with some commonly asked questions. Number one, what about monopolies? What's to prevent one company from taking everything over if there's no state regulation? It's actually a very valid question, but the solutions are very simple. So let's break it down. They've got you thinking that the state is the only thing between you and a corporate dystopia. Like, if we didn't have regulators breathing down every CEO's neck, Jeff Bezos would corner every market, buy up all the farms, and start charging you for air. But history tells us a different story. The biggest monopolies in the world didn't rise by outcompeting everyone else through merit. They rose because the state had already built the power structures that concentrated control. And then these companies just exploited those structures through regulatory capture. And if you don't already know what regulatory capture is, it's when a company or a corporation buys out the agency that's supposed to be regulating them, and then they pimp the regulatory laws to their own benefit. Let's look at Rockefeller, for example. Standard Oil is exhibit A of the free market gone too far, right? Well, no, not really. When you actually dig into it, his dominance didn't come from merit. It came from shady backdoor deals with the railroads, many of which were subsidized by the government, surprise, so he could ship oil cheaper than anyone else. That wasn't innovation. That was an unfair advantage that was only made possible by the state. He also used the courts like a weapon. And when smaller competitors tried to push back over price fixing, unfair shipping rates, or market manipulation, the courts almost always sided with him. Not because he was right, but because he had them in his pocket. And when the Sherman Act came along and broke up Standard Oil, it didn't hurt him. It locked in his wealth. He had already diversified his holdings across the new companies and walked away richer than ever. He was probably skipping. So no, this wasn't a free market failure. It was a system designed for insiders that Rockefeller knew exactly how to play. And none of it, not one piece, would have been possible without the state. Then there's AT&T. In 1913, they cut a deal with the U.S. government to where they'd provide universal service in exchange for being allowed to legally dominate the phone system. So for decades, if you wanted a phone line at all, you had one option, AT&T. Not because they were the best, not because they outcompeted everyone else, but because it was illegal for competitors to offer service. Let me say that again. It was illegal for competitors to offer service. You couldn't build your own network. You couldn't choose a different provider. You were locked in across the board by law. And just like with every other monopoly, innovation screeched to a halt, prices stayed high, and the service sucked because there was no competition pushing them to be better. It wasn't until the courts broke them up in the 80s that we finally saw some progress. Suddenly there was competition, new companies, and a wave of innovation in mobile tech and internet infrastructure. So, was the AT&T monopoly the result of a free market? No, not even close. It was literally a state-sponsored chokehold over an entire industry. Now, those are just two examples, but like we could sit here for hours and not get through all the examples in history. So, if there's no regulation, what actually prevents monopolies from cornering the free market and landing us right back where we started? Simple. It's you. It's me. It's everyone. as long as the market stays free. So no subsidies, no licensing barriers, no government favors, and monopolies don't last. Because in a real free market, power's temporary. You got to keep earning it. And if a company starts treating people like crap, someone else builds a better option. If they overcharge, someone undercuts. If they slack off, they get replaced. There's three forces that keep that system honest. Number one is competition. With no government licensing fees, it's easier to start a new business and enter the market. That creates more competition, which incentivizes higher quality goods and services and forces companies who want to keep their customers to have a good, number two, reputation. People do business with companies that they trust. So if a company starts doing sketchy shit, word gets around fast, and there's plenty of other competitors to do business with through number three, voluntary choice. Nobody's locked into doing business with anybody. You can walk away, you can switch to a better option, or you can build your own. But none of that works if the game is rigged. When the state steps in to protect consumers by outlawing competition, handing out subsidies, or creating enough red tape to drown small upstart businesses, that's not protection, that's control. And that's how you get these corporate cartels that are propped up by these laws that shield them from challenge. So, if we really want to prevent monopolies, we don't regulate harder. We take away the state's power to rig the game in the first place. All right, next question. How would currency or trade work without a central system? It already does. Barter, local currencies, time banks, crypto, and commodity trades. These aren't theoretical, guys. They're already working in communities all over the world. Real value doesn't come from paper printed by a central bank. It comes from trust, skill, time, resources, and agreed-upon exchange. Money at its core is just a shared story, a tool that humans use to represent value. And we've used everything from salt, silver, and cattle to shells and beads. The Yapese people of Micronesia used these massive carved limestone discs as currency. Native tribes in North America traded with wampum, strings of beads made from shells. In West Africa, cowrie shells were used all over the place to trade for centuries. Even in prisons today, people trade with ramen and cigarettes. You know, so the point is that currency evolves. People don't need permission to trade, they just need something that others value. In a free society, currency systems would be open source. There'd be multiple forms of value, all voluntary, competing for people's trust. So that no inflation tax, no monopoly, just money that actually works because people choose it. That's how money stays honest. Throughout history, commerce has been one of the greatest forces for peace. Groups that trade with each other don't need to fight. It's more profitable to cooperate and exchange value than it is to go to war over resources. So money's not the root of all evil. And we don't need a central authority to tell us how to exchange value. We just need the freedom to choose how we do it. But people are selfish. Won't they just do whatever benefits them? Yes. Yes, and that's the point. Self-interest isn't evil, guys. It's natural. The trick is building systems where individual self-interest also benefits others and the earth. That's what voluntary trade does. That's what local food systems like farmers markets, mutual aid, and skill exchanges do. You help someone build a shed, and they bring you eggs every week for an agreed-upon period of time. That's self-interest aligned with service. We don't need to fight human nature. We need to work with it and build our systems around it to maximize its potential for good. Well, sure, this works on a small scale, but what about cities, millions of people, global systems? No top-down system has ever scaled well without eventually collapsing under its own weight. Look at Rome. Look at all the empires throughout history. Decentralization is how nature works. Ecosystems scale horizontally like a web. They don't stack vertically like our current systems. Living ecosystems scale through feedback loops, relationships, and adaptation. We don't need one massive system. We need thousands of small, resilient ones that can voluntarily trade, share knowledge, and collaborate where needed without coercion. What's to stop someone from faking virtue and exploiting the system? Nothing. And that's why trust matters. This way of life demands discernment. It demands healthy boundaries, real relationships, and consequences when people cross the line. That's why decentralization is the key. Because when someone poisons one well, it doesn't taint the whole system. Contrast that with the centralized systems that we have now, where one corrupt leader can sell out millions of people and never face a consequence. Where fraud and abuse are protected by bureaucracy and layers of it. In a free system, liars don't last long. They get exposed, shunned, or simply ignored.
Well, that just sounds like total anarchy. Isn't that just chaos without laws or governments?
No. Chaos is what we already have. I'm saying that no one should be forced into systems that they didn't choose. If people want to come together and form their own government, write laws, pay for services, and live by shared rules, awesome. More power to them. That's volunteerism. That's choice. But if you're forcing others to participate under threat of violence, taxation, or imprisonment, that's not freedom. That's soft tyranny. This isn't about chaos or lawlessness. It's about consent. What we're talking about is organic order, decentralized, self-regulating, resilient. People cooperating voluntarily because it works better than fighting. Families raising kids with values. Communities setting their own standards. Natural incentives creating real-world checks and balances, just like a forest ecosystem. That's not chaos. That's life outside the zoo. That's reality. That's nature. Call it anarchy, volunteerism, agorism. The label doesn't matter. The principle is simple. No one has the moral right to rule over peaceful people without their consent. Not a king, not a president, not a mob with a ballot. And if a system really works, you shouldn't need to force anyone into it. The kind of change that we're talking about isn't going to happen overnight, guys. And you know what? It shouldn't. If it did, the collapse would hurt more people than it helped, because there's a lot of people who just aren't ready yet to live this way. And forcing them into it would go against every single thing that we stand for and everything that we talked about today. This isn't going to be some, like I said earlier, some glorious social revolution that I'm advocating for here. In fact, I adamantly stand against that. This has to be a gradual shift that unfolds over generations. Slowly, intentionally, through practice, not panicked, desperate actions. And you know what? We probably won't even see the full results in our lifetime. But that's exactly why it matters. We have to learn this deeply so we can teach it. Not just pass on the facts, but to raise a generation that understands what freedom actually is, what it costs, and why it's worth everything. Because without the freedom to try and to fail, we can't grow. We can't evolve. And right now, that evolution is not optional. The system is dying. And if we don't build a stronghold that's rooted in something better, it will take us down with it. If you've got kids, it starts there. If you don't, it still matters just as much. Talk to your friends, your community, anyone who will listen. You don't need a bloodline to think long term. You just need courage and skin in the game. You need to give a shit. Because building these parallel systems, despite the dominance of the old one, that's the ultimate act of rebellion. You're not just protesting, you're actively replacing. You're rendering the existing model irrelevant, one action at a time. Like Buckminster Fuller, a very wise man with an unfortunate name, once said, "You never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete." Here's the hard truth. This only works if the individual is strong enough to carry it. A free world depends on people who are honest, self-accountable, and ready to rise to the challenge. And maybe, just maybe, the nihilistic critics are right. Maybe people just can't handle freedom. But I believe that we can. I believe in humanity because I believe in myself, and that's where it starts. If you're still on the fence about trusting people, I've got two things for you. First, if you're trusting the systems that we have now, aren't you already trusting people? Bureaucrats, bankers, politicians, they're people. You're already betting on someone else's judgment. You're just betting on people who you've never met, who don't know you, and who profit off your dependence. And second, it's not about whether those people out there can handle freedom. It's about whether you can. Are you the kind of person who can handle it? Can you carry it? Can you live it? Because here's the truth. You're not being controlled. There's no phantom congressman hovering above your head, keeping record of every action you take and giving you gold stars or demerits. There's no senator with his hand lodged up your ass, steering you like a sock puppet. There's no president pulling your strings. You're already free. You've just been trained to act like you're not. So the question is not, can this work? The question is, what are you going to do with the freedom you already have? What kind of world do you believe in enough to start building right now? To quote Marcus Aurelius, waste no more time arguing what a good man should be. Be one. Find what you were put here to do and do it. There will always be obstacles, but there will also always be solutions. In permaculture, we say, the more restrictions there are, the more eloquent the design must be. Don't waste any more time or energy convincing yourself that you can't. Ask yourself instead how you can, then start taking steps every single day to design your life and take your freedom back. All right. You guys okay? I told you it was going to be a ride. Well, if you're still around, let's keep it moving. Let's talk about flowers with our plant of the week. This week is the sunchoke, or the Jerusalem artichoke, Helianthus tuberosus. This flowering plant has a lot more than meets the eye. At first glance, you think it's some variety of sunflower, but it has no relation whatsoever to the artichoke, and it's not from Jerusalem. It's actually a perennial tuber, and an absolutely badass multifunctional plant that's packed with nutrients. It's extremely drought tolerant, and it'll grow just about anywhere, including the kind of dry, neglected soil that would make most people just look the other way. You can find the tubers at the grocery store, break off a piece, stick it in the ground, and bam, just like that, you've got a perennial food system. That alone makes it a symbol of everything that we talked about this week. Taking what's available from these centralized supply chains and using it to build long-lasting independence. You don't need permission. You don't need fertilizer. You don't even need to water it half the damn time. I planted mine a little over a month ago in a random dry patch of soil up here on the property just to see if they'd take. You know, it was an experiment. And I've only watered them maybe two or three times since then. Right now, they're a foot and a half tall and thriving like they own a place. So the tubers spread aggressively underground into each one a rich source of prebiotic fiber that feeds beneficial gut microbes and stabilizes your blood sugar. It's one of the best foods that you can grow if you're thinking about long-term resilience or even just stretching your grocery budget with something regenerative and extremely low maintenance. Above ground, it's a tall sunflower-like plant that creates dense biomass for chop-and-drop mulch, habits for pollinators, and it makes a great fodder crop for rabbits or poultry. It can even be a natural windbreak if you let it form a wall. Below ground, it's rebuilding your soil without you having to lift a finger, and quietly building a self-replicating food system that's nearly impossible to get rid of once you start it. Does that sound like something we were just talking about? Huh. The sunchoke is a perfect symbol of decentralized freedom. It's easy to propagate. It's resilient as hell. It's quietly powerful and proactively apathetic to centralized control. They're also surprisingly versatile in the kitchen. You can slice them raw into salads for a nutty, crunchy texture, kind of like water chestnuts, right? You can roast them like potatoes with olive oil, salt, and herbs. You'll get this caramelized, earthy flavor that's just very unique. It's hard to beat. They also make killer soup. You know, throw them in with some chicken, with some garlic, onions, whatever. They're creamy, they're savory, and loaded with gut-supporting inulin. If you're into fermentation, they pickle beautifully. They get crunchy, tangy, probiotic-rich. They're awesome. If you've never eaten them before, just don't go overboard eating a ton of them right away. People call them fartichokes for a reason. The inulin can cause gas if your gut's not used to it. So don't eat 1,000 of them at once. Start slow. Eat a couple. Get your gut used to it. And everyone else in the room will thank you. All in all, if you want to build food sovereignty, sunchokes definitely belong in your tool chest and in your kitchen. All right. Now let's get tactical and crack into our tactic for tough times or good ones. This week's topic, starting a micro business for financial independence. One of the single most powerful actions you can take to increase your level of independence in your life is to create an alternative income stream. Whether that means starting a full-scale business, running a weekend side hustle, or offering a service to your neighbors that fills the gap. Once you build it, it's yours. There's no boss that can fire you, there's no sudden layoffs, and there's no one that can take it away from you. Provided that you do it smart if you're riding that gray market line, you know? The more income streams that you stack, the more resilient you become. You're building redundancy. You're not completely dependent on just a single paycheck. So if one stream dries up, the others are still flowing. You're decentralizing your own personal economy. And, you know, you might look out there and it might seem like everything's crashing down around us economically and socially, but there's actually never been a better time to build something of your own for two reasons. Number one, right now, we have more access to niche markets than any other generation ever before us. Between social media, web platforms, and online marketplaces, it's easier to advertise, it's easier to learn skills, and it's easier to automate the systems that keep your business running. And secondly, hard times crack the system open. The chaos of these changing times creates an abundance of fresh opportunities, because when everything's in a state of flux, people stop caring about brand names and start looking for real value, practical solutions, genuine people with real skills, things that work. That's where you come in. Some of the most iconic American companies were born in the depths of major economic crisis. General Motors launched in 1908, right in the middle of a major recession. Hewlett-Packard, otherwise known as HP, the printer company, was born in a garage during the Great Depression in 1939, right in the middle of it. Revlon, Disney, and United Airlines were also all built right in the middle of the Depression when most people were barely surviving. Now, I'm not advocating for these businesses and saying that they're, you know, companies that I admire. Like, I can't stand Disney, you know? But when I drop that name, every single one of you knows what I'm talking about. And the point is that these guys didn't wait for the perfect conditions. In fact, they built during one of the most economically tumultuous decades in U.S. history. Yet, they became some of the most successful companies ever. Now, starting your own business is not easy. It's one of the hardest things you'll ever do. If it were easy, everyone would do it. But if you can push through the early pain, the awkwardness, the self-doubt, there's nothing more liberating than building something that's truly yours. Your brand, your style, your voice, your value, given on your terms. Every business starts with one thing, a problem. That's it. Something real that people want solved. Maybe it's, I don't have time to fix my deck. Or maybe somebody wants local eggs that they can trust. Or maybe someone else is sick of store-bought sour bread that tastes like freaking cardboard. I don't know. If you can just solve one problem for one kind of person, congratulations, you've got yourself a business idea. I'm oversimplifying, obviously, but you don't have to be an expert in marketing, sales, operations, customer experience, and everything else all at once. You just need enough skill to do one thing well, or at least well enough to get someone to pay you for it. And you need to be able to treat that customer so well that they remember your name and want to do business with you again. Or they want to pass your info along through word of mouth. You need to build trust. If you're not a master of your craft yet, there's no shame in that. As long as you're not doing shoddy work, you know? So practice fixing your own tools before you start advertising small engine repair. Don't be an idiot about it. Test your salve recipe on yourself before trying to sell it. Learn to stop your own sink from leaking before you offer plumbing as a service. Pick something you're already good at, or that you enjoy doing enough to invest time into building that skill. Screw up while the stakes are low. What separates the businesses that make it from the ones who don't isn't branding or business cards. It's quality, it's integrity, and it's grit. Period. You will doubt yourself. You will mess up. You will have weeks where nothing comes in and you wonder what the hell you're doing. That's all part of the process. The people who win are the ones who keep going even when it's boring, slow, or brutally difficult. And you don't need to build an empire unless that's what you want. You just need an offer. I'll build your fence, $500 flat. You know, comfrey salve for joint pain, $12 a tin. Lawn care, $50, I'll do your yard. That's it. That's commerce. And yes, you need people to know that you exist. If nobody knows what you're doing, it's not a business, it's a hobby. So find a way to advertise. Tell people, post it, share it, offer it. Put flyers up, knock on doors if you have to. Every successful business owner started out nervous to speak up. Eventually, yes, you're going to need to put some kind of systems in place, whether, you know, to figure out where your money goes, how you take payments, how you keep track of it all, how you set boundaries so that your time doesn't get hijacked. But you don't need to wait until you've got an LLC and a 5-page business plan. Start now. Learn on the fly. Sell some eggs. Build something for someone. Build chicken coops out of pallets that you find on the side of the road and sell them on Craigslist. I don't know. There's a million things that you could do. Do one thing well. Let it grow from there. I know a guy locally who built a compost pickup business on a bike. He gives each customer a 5-gallon bucket, and once a week, they leave it by the curb. He shows up with his little bike trailer, hauls it away, and sells the compost to local soil dealers. He gets paid on both ends. It's freaking genius. And my own handyman business, it started with odd jobs on the side. You know, just doing random little piddly things here and there. But now it pays my bills, it feeds my family, it allows me the schedule flexibility to do what I really love and to give it to you guys for free, which is what you're listening to right now. It's been hands down the single most impactful thing that I've done in my life to achieve more freedom and independence. It can be something more passive too. You know, just something that you're already doing and you want to upscale it a little bit to make some extra cash on the side. If you're growing sweet potatoes, grow a few extra and sell the slips. You know, brew some kombucha, split and sell the scobies. It doesn't matter what you do, just do something. Because when you own something, even something small, you take that much of your power back. Skill is security. Ownership is freedom. That side hustle might only make a small dent to start off, but if you keep at it and you do it well, that side hustle can turn into a full-time income that feeds your family, builds your wealth, and puts your life, your freedom, back in your own hands. So now let's get into our skill highlight of the week. This week we're going to be talking about designing like nature, an introduction to permaculture principles. And I'm stoked to get into this one with you guys. So let's break down, what the hell is permaculture, right? Permaculture is the science of designing systems that work based on the functions of nature. You hear the word permaculture thrown around in passing a lot more these days, and most folks associate it with some vague image of regenerative agriculture, maybe some fruit trees, some mulch rings, or a garden that waters itself. And yeah, those things are part of it. I mean, permaculture, agriculture, right? Well, not exactly. There's so much more to permaculture than just growing food. Permaculture is an ethical science for designing living systems for people that are not only sustainable for us, but that also harmonize with the natural world. Whoa. Back up. That's an absolutely
packed sentence. So let's take it apart piece by piece so we're not missing anything. The first word, ethical. So permaculture is an ethical, right? So if something's ethical, it has a moral compass. It means we're not just asking, can this be done? We're asking, should it? It means we measure outcomes not just by efficiency or profit, but by how they impact people, ecosystems, and future generations. Now, science is a method of testing theories to determine how something functions. Science means you observe, you test, you refine. You're working with nature, not opinions. Permaculture is grounded in patterns that have stood the test of time. The water cycle, the carbon cycle, succession, the behavior of forests, the logic of a mycelial network. These aren't metaphors. They're these ancient natural systems that we can observe and model our designs after. It's not dogma. It's applied pattern literacy. It's seeing patterns out in nature and applying their principles to our designs. Because it works. You know? It's worked out there for way longer than any of us have even been here. So it's common sense. You know? The idea of ethical science is huge. Because a lot of modern science doesn't bother asking the question of should we do this. Bill Mollison, the founder of permaculture, said it best. Science without ethics is sociopathy. And he was 100% right. Think about all the stuff we've seen in recent decades. Genetically engineered organisms released into ecosystems with barely a second thought. Lab-designed seed-pesticide combos that kill pollinators. Pharmaceutical experiments with devastating side effects that just get swept under the rug. That's science without ethics. Sure, it's clever, but it's reckless. Permaculture says slow down. Think it through. Ask what your solution will cost beyond just money. So permaculture is an ethical science of designing. This is where it gets fun. To design something is to intentionally shape a system to serve a purpose. Not just slap things together randomly with duct tape and hope that it works. Design means you think in relationships. You ask questions like, what's the input? What's the output? Where does the waste go? Can that waste be repurposed as a resource elsewhere in the system? A well-designed permaculture system is like a jazz band. Each part's doing its thing, but also listening and adjusting to the others. And the more constraints that you have, the more elegant your design has to become. That's part of the genius. It forces creativity. So permaculture is an ethical science of designing living systems for people. When we say living systems, we're not talking about ecosystems that are biologically alive, right? We're talking about the systems that people live in. We're talking about homes, homesteads, communities, entire societies, how we structure our water, our food, our housing, our energy, our trade, our education, and even our dispute resolution. A living system is one that supports life, not just for the individual, but for the families and communities that make up a culture. They're the structures that we rely on every day, whether we built them intentionally or whether we were born into and inherited them. Permaculture asks, what would it look like to design these systems based on the way that nature functions? And nature doesn't run on ideology. It runs on feedback. It balances competition and collaboration in dynamic co-creation with each other. Living things don't evolve by being coddled. They evolve by being challenged, while still benefiting from mutual aid, symbiosis, and redundancy. Imagine structuring our communities the same way. A system where individuals are free to experiment, create, and fail, without being crushed by central mandates or locked into one-size-fits-all solutions. But also a system where families, neighbors, and peers voluntarily support one another in meaningful ways, sharing skills, trading value, solving real problems together, not because of some utopian collectivist ideal that's enforced by the state, but because it's in everyone's self-interest to do so. Again, we're talking about decentralized society here that's resilient because it adapts. It isn't rigidly managed from some centralized point that if that fails, everything else suffers. Permaculture says, don't just fight the system. Outgrow it. Use nature as the blueprint and build a new model that makes the old one obsolete just because it works better.
build homes in neighborhoods that produce food, that produce energy, that produce the things that people need. Create communities that don't rely on brittle supply chains or centralized control. Solve the real problems society faces with practical design, not ideology. This isn't about utopia for probably the 100th time today. It's about durability. It's about common sense. It's about giving form to the kind of life that we actually want to live and making sure that way of life can last. So let's get back to our sentence. So permaculture is an ethical science of designing living systems for people that are not only sustainable. We're almost done, guys, I promise. But let's break down what sustainable means. It doesn't just mean green or eco-friendly. If something's truly sustainable, it produces more energy than it consumes. It builds capacity over time, not just to survive, but to thrive. It generates enough surplus to reinvest back into the system that created it, back into the hands of the people who keep that system alive and put it towards the good of future generations. If a system only breaks even, it's not sustainable. We're aiming at self-replicating regenerative systems, like a healthy forest or like a yeast culture that doubles every few hours. That's sustainability. It gets better. It doesn't just subsist. So, permaculture is an ethical science of designing living systems for people that are not only sustainable for us, but harmonize with the natural world. This last bit might be the most understood part. Harmony doesn't mean hands off. It doesn't mean that we're separate beings and nature is some pristine wilderness that gets harmed every time we go near it. It means we build our systems with nature's patterns instead of against them. You don't go and drain the swamp so you can build garden beds there. You build floating gardens that turn the swamp into a food system. You don't kill every pest insect with chemical cocktails. You plant the flowers that bring in the predators to handle them for you. You don't till the hell out of your soil. You work with biology to build it up over time. In permaculture, nature isn't a barrier. It's the engine. You get better results with less effort when you align your system with natural forces rather than trying to dominate them. So now let's reread that full sentence one last time with this now much richer understanding and take a second to really absorb what it means. So permaculture is an ethical science of designing living systems for people that are not only sustainable for us, but that also harmonize with the natural world. Now you can feel the full weight of it. It's not just a style of gardening. It's a framework for everything. For agriculture, for architecture, for economics, for education, family, and culture. This is it, guys. This is how we design our way through the complex problems facing modern society. I'm not saying that it's a silver bullet or the magic fix for everything, but I am saying with the utmost conviction that this is the clearest framework I have ever found for making sense of this world and for building something real and resilient that actually lasts and that every single one of us can be part of. No matter who we are, no matter where we come from, no matter what our status is. Like, I'm really not kidding here. I know it kind of sounds like a bold statement, but seriously, hear me out. Climate change? Permaculture. Because healthy ecosystems pull carbon from the air and rebuild the water cycle. Tyranny? Permaculture. Because you can't control people who meet their own needs locally. Poverty? Again, permaculture. Because teaching someone to grow, build, and trade is real empowerment. Food security? Also permaculture, because local supply chains don't break down when global ones do, and a community full of people that are engaged in voluntary collaboration and producing their own food, 9 times out of 10, would go out of their way to help someone in the community that's in need. Water scarcity? Permaculture, because you can design your land to hold every drop that falls from the sky, even in the most extremely dry and arid climates in the world. This has actually been proven to work in places like Jordan in the Middle East by Jeff Lawton in his Greening the Desert project. It's super badass. Go look it up. Mental health crisis. Let's see here. Permaculture. Because working with nature brings purpose, rhythm, and connection. And it gives people an alternative from this drolling, gray, fucking stressful mess that we have in society today. That's the root cause of these mental health issues. Social fragmentation. Huh, that's a tough one. Permaculture. Because people who build value together tend to put their differences aside to preserve that value and to take care of each other. Educational failure? Let me think. Permaculture. Because kids learn more by planting a seed or building a goat shed than by regurgitating facts that they don't care about and memorizing test answers that they're going to forget by next semester. This isn't some idealistic, naive vision where everything's going to be sunshine and butterflies with unicorns flying around and shooting rainbows out of their asses, guys. This is a tangible, accessible, pragmatic science for designing solutions to the problems that we can face in the modern world. The original vision from Bill Mollison and David Holmgren was formed by studying the commonalities of indigenous cultures from all over the world that existed in balance with the natural world for millennia, and then distilling those commonalities down into the design science that we call permaculture. It isn't just about permanent agriculture, like many people commonly misunderstand. It was about creating a permanent culture. A culture built on three foundational ethics. Care of the earth, because if we destroy the soil, the water, and the air, we destroy the foundation of all life. Care for the people, because our systems must meet real human needs without exploitation or dependency. A return of surplus, not redistribution, but reinvestment. The surplus feeds the system that generated it so it can grow, replicate, and evolve. If the ethics are the roots, the 12 principles are the branches. They give us a toolkit for thinking, for designing, and for troubleshooting the problems. I'm going to fire through these a little bit more rapidly because I've left my very supportive and very pregnant lady with our two very feral children so that I could sneak away and record a podcast episode. And I've got to get back to it. But stick around and we will definitely be going through these all again in much greater depth in future episodes. So first off, we have the principle of observe and interact. Before we take any action, take a minute. Observe and understand what's really happening in the existing ecosystem, on your property, in your garden, in your relationships, in your community. What's working? What's not? Effective change that actually creates beneficial interactions starts with understanding how something functions through awareness. Number two, catch and store energy. Don't let good things go to waste. Whether it's water, sunlight, money, time, or even momentum, build systems that harvest and store value so that it's there when you need it. So, for one example, this could be putting in a swale at the base of a hillside to slow, soak, and spread all the rain runoff that's going to come down that hill, and establish your food production systems around your catchment. Number three, obtain a yield. Every system you build should give you something back. Food, money, joy, knowledge. If it doesn't feed you, literally or metaphorically, you're going to burn out on it because you're going to be putting in all this work and time and effort without getting a return for your effort. Number four, apply self-regulation and accept feedback. Nature self-regulates. You should too. Learn from your mistakes. Don't double down on an idea that you're emotionally attached to that just isn't working. The principle is about humility and course correction. Number five, use and value renewable resources and services. Work with what renews itself, like sun, wind, compost, human creativity. Don't rely on extractive systems that burn out. That goes for energy and for people. Number six, produce no waste. In nature, waste doesn't exist. Everything gets reused, repurposed, and reintegrated. When a fruit falls from a tree and rots on the forest floor, the flesh feeds the fungi and the insects, and the seed sprouts new life. And even the decay enriches the soil. Nothing's wasted. Every scrap is fuel for something else. That's the kind of loop that we're aiming for. In your life, your relationships, your businesses, your garden, Design systems where every output becomes an input somewhere else. That's how you build resilience. By closing the loop and feeding the system that you're building instead of leaking what could actually be a resource. 7, design from patterns to details. If you stare long enough into nature, you'll notice an infinite number of patterns. You'll notice the connections and energy, and you'll discover that all of these patterns are rooted in one core master pattern called the torus. A tree pulls nutrients up through its roots to feed its branches and leaves. Those leaves soak in sunlight, transform energy, and eventually fall back to the earth. As they break down, they feed the soil that feeds the tree. It's a perfect loop, a continuous cycle where the output becomes the input. That's a torus, a self-sustaining, regenerative flow of energy and matter circling back to nourish the source. That's how we design. 8, integrate rather than segregate. Connection is power. A garden bed next to a chicken coop on a downhill slope so that the rainwater washes nitrogen from the chicken shit right into the garden bed. A business skill that supports your homestead, or a homestead skill that supports your business. Strong systems are built on internal, intentional relationships and connections. And the more interconnected your systems are, the more resilient your entire design will be. And again, this principle applies to everything from your garden to society as a whole. 9, use small and slow solutions. This one's huge, and I'll be the first to admit that I've definitely gotten it wrong before. If you get, you get all fired up about freedom and self-reliance, and then suddenly you're planting a full-blown food forest, chickens, ducks, meat rabbits, a black soldier fly bin, bluegill and aquaponics, and a worm bin, all in your first season. Do yourself a favor, don't do that. Don't try to do it all at once. You'll end up spread way too thin, overwhelmed, and ready to torch the whole thing before you see any kind of return. So start small. Pick one piece. Build a system that actually works and feeds you something tangible, whether that's food, money, compost, or sanity. Then grow it from there. Test it. Tweak it. Let it evolve with you. And when you're thinking about bigger moves like, carving a pond into that perfect hilltop, make damn sure that it's not going to flood your house. That type of irreversible mistake in permaculture is called a type 1 error. You want to avoid these like your freedom depends on it, because sometimes it does. And this principle doesn't just apply to homesteading either. It applies to life, to business, to society. Sweeping legislation, centralized reform, one-size-fits-all fixes, they usually do more harm than good. Build systems that grow with you, that scale with your energy, and don't collapse under their own weight. 10, use and value diversity. Monocultures are fragile. Diversity in an ecosystem is strength. And not just in ecosystems, but in communities, economies, and ideas. But let's be clear, diversity isn't valuable just for its own sake. Random variation without purpose is just chaotic and disjointed. What makes diversity powerful is function. In a plant guild, you don't just toss a dozen species in a bed and hope for the best. You stack rolls. A fruit tree is the anchor. Legumes to fix nitrogen. Yarrow to mine minerals. Thyme to cover the ground. And marigold to deter pests. They don't compete. They complement each other. The whole system thrives because of the differences, not in spite of them. The same goes for human systems. The craftsman, the cook, the builder, the thinker. Different people bring different strengths. That's the point. It's not about uniformity, it's about contribution. The more unique value each individual person or plant species brings, the stronger the whole thing becomes. When you design for diversity with intention, you get something that's more dynamic, more alive, and more tough. You get ecology. 11, use edges and value the marginal. All abundance occurs at the edges, where the forest meets the field, where cultures clash, where ideas get uncomfortable. That's where the magic happens. The most life, the most energy, the most opportunity always shows up at the boundaries, not in the middle. That's where systems interact. Tension sparks innovation, and nature throws a party of unexpected possibilities. If you want more yield, don't look to the center. Stretch your edge. Number 12, creatively use and respond to change. Change is really the only constant in life, in your garden, and in the world. Don't just squint your eyes and grit your teeth and brace for impact. Design for it. A late frost swipes out your seedlings. Build a cold frame next season. The price of feed skyrockets. Stack functions and grow fodder trees. Rotate chickens through garden beds. Build a black soldier fly bin. Society's freaking about this week's doomsday news headline. That's your signal to rethink your blueprint and design your way towards more preparedness. Nature doesn't freeze when things shift. It adapts. It evolves. And so can you. Change is not the end. It's the invitation to a new beginning. So to wrap it up, it should be pretty clear by now that permaculture is not just for farmers or folks who own land. It's a skill set for literally anyone who wants to be more effective in the way that they think about their work, their finances, their family life, and the way that they interact with the world. It's for people who want to take back control of their life. It teaches you how to think in systems and see how different moving parts can connect and synchronize together toward a common goal. How to solve problems in ways that stack value instead of draining it. And how to design a life where all the facets we juggle every day all end up supporting each other instead of pulling you in a million different directions. You don't need acreage, you just need intention. You can apply these principles to your garden or your budget, to your compost pile or your business, to your homestead or your apartment. Permaculture just gives you a lens. And once you start seeing the world through it, you can't unsee it. It's not about being perfect. It's about reciprocity. It's not about going back to the Stone Age. It's about designing systems that actually work for real people in the real world. If you check it out and you decide like I did that permaculture is 100% for you, you don't need to drop $1,500 on a PDC. Those are incredibly valuable and come with some unparalleled benefits, but you can start right now just by reading some books, watching some YouTube videos, joining an online forum where people support each other and share ideas freely. Every new skill that you learn is another tool that you can use to build that life that you really envision for yourself. And permaculture is just what connects all those tools together. All right, now speaking of ancient tools that still hold up today, let's talk about cabbage with our recipe of the week. This week it's Liberty Cabbage, a rebrand born of war. So what the hell is Liberty Cabbage? Well, it's just sauerkraut. But I thought that the name tied in well with this week's topics and thought that it would be a good opportunity to tie a little bit of lesser-known history into one of the world's most classic and ancient methods of food preservation. So during World War I, anti-German sentiment in the U.S. ran so hot that even food got caught in the crossfire. Sauerkraut, which is traditionally German, suddenly became unpatriotic to sell or eat. So in 1918, American sauerkraut producers decided to rebrand the food as Liberty Cabbage in an effort to keep sales strong while distancing the product from its German roots. It was a PR move, but also a perfect example of how even the most ancient practical traditions, like fermenting a cabbage, can be wrapped in the politics of the day. The funny thing is, the name didn't really stick, but the fermentation method remains undefeated to this day. So what do you need to make sauerkraut? Salt and cabbage. That's literally it. You're going to finely shred your cabbage. You can use a mandolin to get it really nice and even, or you can just chop it by hand, even though it's going to take a little bit more time. Then you're going to weigh your cabbage and add between 1.5 to 2% the total weight in salt. From there, you're going to mix in your salt and you're going to massage your cabbage until the salt draws all the water out and you have a nice salty brine. This usually takes between 10 and 20 minutes of vigorously squeezing it. And your forearms are probably going to be on fire by the end of it, but so will any dish that you add it to once it's done. Next, you're going to stick it in a mason jar, weigh it down with something so that the sauerkraut stays submerged below the brine. And you can get one of those, you know, glass fermentation weights, or I just use a whole cabbage leaf and like a clean rock, caveman style. Just keep it weighed down. Doesn't matter what you use. Then you're going to take your jar, you're going to label it with the date, because you will forget. You're going to stick it in a cool place like a cupboard or a pantry for about 3 weeks, give or take. Check it out every few days, try to burp it. You can taste it after about 14 days to see if it's good or if you want to let it go longer to really get that classic sauerkraut flavor. And as long as you get your salt ratio right, there's little to no chance of it spoiling during fermentation. And if something does go wrong, you'll notice right away because it'll look and smell terrible. The nose knows, as they say. So that being said, I've been doing this for years and I've never had a single batch go bad on me ever. So if you want to get a little more fancy and add some flair to a classic recipe, try dry roasting some jalapenos and garlic that you'll layer into your cabbage as you jar everything up. And that's going to take your flavor to a whole new level. If you want to go classic German, unlike our friends back in World War I, add some caraway seed into your mixture for that earthy, tangy, old-school kraut taste that's perfect on a Reuben, on a bratwurst, or just eating it out of the jar like a barbarian. If you want to go more medicinal with it, throw some shredded carrots, turmeric root, fresh ginger, and black pepper to the mix for an anti-inflammatory and immune-boosting gut biome balm that's zesty, warming, and has that subtle kick from the ginger that'll be just perfect in stir-fries, rice bowls, or a healing broth. If you want a variation that's amazing as a salad topper or on some fish tacos, throw in some shredded beetroot and thinly sliced apples. The beets will turn this awesome electric pink color that's just always fun to pull out for guests. There's a million other variations that we could spend another hour talking about. There's pretty much no end to what you can do with sauerkraut. Cabbage is extremely easy to grow. You can do it in a pot on your porch. And if you ferment it with this way, those couple heads of cabbage can easily last you over a year. So sauerkraut is simple, delicious, versatile, and fantastic for your gut health. So it's just a win across the board. Now, if you want the secret to growing the biggest, healthiest, most nutrient-dense and delicious cabbage you've ever had, then consider checking out our book of the month, Regenerative Soil by Matt Powers. This one is hands down one of the coolest books I have ever read, and it fits perfectly in with this week's topic of walking to freedom. Regenerative Soil is more than a book about gardening, it's a blueprint for biological independence. Matt Powers breaks down the complex concepts of soil biology in a way that even I can understand and shows you what's really going on in the soil. Not just chemistry and minerals, but entire decentralized ecosystems of microbes working in perfect synergy. It's the cleanest analogy for a free, voluntary society that you'll ever find. Nature doesn't need top-down control, and neither do we, and the soil proves it. This book teaches how soil biology actually works and how to build it back where it's been destroyed. How to test your soil and decode its behavior without needing a lab. How to compost, inoculate, and regenerate using time-tested biology-driven methods. How to grow healthier food and rebuild ecosystems at the same time. What makes it a game changer is the clarity of this book. Whether you're a total beginner or knee-deep in soil already, Powers gives you the tools and framework to really take action and to understand why it works. I've been going through this course alongside the book, and every chapter has reshaped how I look at the land. I'm planting differently, I'm composting smarter, I'm thinking bigger. If you want to grow food like your freedom depends on it, this is the book, because it does, and it all starts with the soil. Oh, all right, holy crap. So that's going to wrap up this week's Dispatch number 4 and our first official episode of Sustainable Sedition Radio. But before we go, I just want to go over what's going to be in our dispatch directory for the week. So if you liked what you heard today, check back in and you can expect an all-new episode every Monday on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen. You can also find audio recordings of the first 3 dispatches on the website and wherever you listen to the podcast as well. If you want to learn more about who I am and what I do, head to the website sustainablesedition.com, where you can check out our story and the steps that myself and my family are currently taking to put this stuff into practice in real life. You can also browse through our resource page with our growing list of documentaries, trusted experts in the space, and my personal reading list of books that have impacted my life the most. You'll also find on our contact page a form you can fill out to apply to come on the show as a guest for an interview style episode, or options to submit questions that you want answered on air in our upcoming Q&A section. Or if you just want to tell me you like the show or offer feedback, I read everything that you guys send and I'm always absolutely stoked to follow up with you. As always, thank you so much for your time. Until next week, keep on building what thrives and changing times.